All right, time for another chat with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy on our weekly Tacky Talk podcasts. How are you doing, Tacky?
Hey, doing great, Joe. Good to see you again on the day after April Fool's and leading into the Holy Weekend.
That's right, exactly. We're in a new month now and turning a corner, hopefully, on the weather department and hopefully in the pandemic department as well. How's your experience been so far?
Well, like everyone else, I've reached a certain level of exhaustion with COVID-19, and we're still working remotely, which is continuing to be a challenge. We kind of start setting up this session this year on hearings and whatnot. And this time of year, I get a lot of meetings. Generally in person, we have lobbying days, we have forums, we have protesters. Like, people don't realize we do get small protesters. We don't have like a protest that fills the Boston Common, but we do get protesters. And, we have all kinds of activity, including things like school kids visiting the state house. And we're not having that this time, obviously, because of the nature of the pandemic. And we're still moving through the vaccination process. On the plus side, we've been informed that the hole in my carpet may be fixed after so many years of looking at that hole. And some of the holes in my walls will be addressed. People don't realize the building is so very old. And so this good speaker has decided, since we're not there, we're going to take a shot at doing some small repairs to the carpets and some of the wall structures, and cleaning up a few patches here and there to make it a little more professional.
Okay. I thought you meant in your home. So in your state house office. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It's a state house office. Yes. My state house office, if you look at the way my pictures and posters are set up, is actually designed to cover up a damage to the wall from past years.
Oh, that's a good Yankee trick. Very good.
Very good. Like my carpet, I have like a lay down carpet. It's actually hiding holes in the carpet. So, the building is quite old, I remind everybody. And it's not like congressional luxuriousness you see in D.C. We are actually very frugal. I think too frugal at maintaining our own office spaces.
Yeah. Talk a little bit, if you can, about the American Rescue Plan and the money that's coming to Massachusetts and how that's going to be allocated.
Well, we got about 2 years to spend the money. We're looking at a start about $4.6 million straight to the state government. Quincy's getting $46 million, I believe, in that zone. And doesn't count all the other agencies that do work for us, such as QCAP and many others that's going to be dispersed. Right now, there are oversight hearings to see from Representative Dan Hunt's committee. He chairs the Federal Stimulus and Census Review Committee, something like that. I can't remember the whole name right now. But, they've already started holding hearings regarding what happened to the last stimulus money the governor used. So the legislature would like to have more accountability and say about where some of this money ends up. The challenge of the budget is going to be that the money received is much more restrictive than what's going to cities and towns. So it's very COVID-directed. For example, higher education, both public and private, to be administered through the state, specifically regarding COVID-related issues. Broadband and technology assistance for school kids are going to be distributed from us. But again, it's going to be COVID-related. Obviously, healthcare system, I don't have to talk about it. I think everybody is now familiar with the healthcare system issues of COVID-19. And of course, we're still moving through, expanded unemployment benefits and variations of different PPP. It seems like there's always another program on this. But, very important, the state's still administering that unemployment benefits, even though unemployment numbers have somewhat stabilized in terms of new people getting on and gone down a little bit as we moved into the warmer months. But the reality is that there's still a lot of folks on unemployment benefits right now, especially in the hospitality industry. And I would point out one specific sector, such as hotel workers. They're looking maybe a multi-year recovery. Unlike some other industries, is they're trying to not completely shut down their industries. Obviously, we have a small number of motels in Quincy. I've been informed that they've had an okay year last year, largely because they were helping during pandemic. A lot of COVID-19 patients were put in, I won't name the facilities because of free people, but they were put in hotels and then sanitized. And then healthcare workers were also using hotels paid by the hospital, which was going to be paid by COVID-19 money,
right?
Because they can't go home to their families, and also the need of being close to the hospitals.
Yeah, they weren't so dependent on travelers as they were, folks locally.
Yeah, the healthcare industry folks, these guys have been through the ringer more than other folks because of this emotional and physical tasking role of taking care of COVID-19 patients and putting themselves in danger. They're in the environment a lot, and you know, there were infection, there were, you know, daily infection rates among the hospital staff.
Yep.
And it doesn't mean you have to be a nurse or a doctor. I mean, you could be an administrator, a food handler, and, you know, people forget about the laundry people. I mean, there's a lot of mucus and saliva and, you know, all the respiratory fluids all over the bed sheets and the room and all that. So the cleaning crews, you know, basically wearing hazmat suits and there's infection rates there. So, I mean, you know, anybody that works in the healthcare industry, whether they're keeping an eye on the front door or, you know, deep into the ICU and everything in the middle, you know, have been very stressed out.
Yeah, plus vendors that have to go into those facilities too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of my friends was an attorney, you know, had medical people come to her home regarding quick legal advice on last wills and testaments during the pandemic because they're very concerned about whether or not they're going to leave their estates intact or they're going into the hospitals. Just to put that in perspective, it's not like you and I looking at our final will and testaments before heading to work.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Can some of the COVID relief money be used, do you think, for the problems that Quincy College is facing due to declining enrollment because of the pandemic?
That's a good question, because Quincy College is kind of one of the quirkier ones because it's a municipally owned college, even though it acts like a private entity.
Right.
The last one of this type of governing format on the east side of Mississippi. All the other ones that have been like this either got absorbed into a state system or completely spun off and went out of business. So we're going to have to work to see how we address this kind of a unique situation, because it's not a state-owned facility. It's not a conventional private college. You know, I'm sure that the delegation is going to have to talk to the administration more about how much relief we can get over there and can we get the more relief.
Yeah, exactly. I know that the new president there is putting together a report to give to the city council soon. They're looking to, as you know, fully fund their pension obligations through the state, the city bond issue that may be or may not be approved too. So there's a lot going on now that's going to depend on the future of that school.
Yeah, for people who don't know, Quincy College is kind of a weird critter because the taxpayers don't pay directly for the college. But they are city employees, so they get the benefit of having the city's healthcare program and a participant in the contributory pension system. So the employees at the college contribute to the system.
Mm.
So the city engages any kind of changes in their local retirement program. So if, let's say they do a home petition to us on doing an early buyout, or they need to adjust their system, you know, that they affect it as well as when we dictate changing contribution levels, new employees at Quincy College, for example, treated the same as new employees at City Hall. Mm. You know, for the purpose of pension contributions, because it's much higher for new employees than old employees. And they're subject to collective bargaining issues. So, you know, in the state law, you know, they're public employees, so they have the same collective bargaining rights. But, you know, even though they're pretty much 100% funded from acquiring money themselves, whether in the form of tuition, grants, or donations, they're on their own. So, you know, it'll be interesting how the mayor navigates Quincy College's portion. And don't forget, we're still paying pensions for the old Quincy Hospital.
Oh, sure. Yes, that's right.
When Quincy Hospital was sold completely off to Quincy Medical Center at the time, you know, one of the part of the deal was that the current employees would be still in the pension system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There would be no new employees getting to be part of the city pension. So as Quincy College, Quincy Hospital has finally closed, there were still employees that were still part of the city pension program. But because there's no new employees to pay for the pensions of those folks, it's like Social Security. If you have no people paying in the future, the people collect now, it creates a bit of a liability problem.
Yep.
So, I mean, pension liability is really twofold. One is because just like the state and the federal government did to Social Security, municipalities, the same thing too, that, you know, they stole from the pension fund essentially and never paid the pension back to balance their budgets. It was a very common practice in the 50s and 60s. And then when the 80s hit, they realized it was a liability, they would be fully funded. So contrary to popular belief, it's not because the pensioners are draining it dry. It's because government had decided back then it was cheaper to balance the budget than actually bill the taxpayers.
Right.
Services.
Yeah, municipal workers now, I know, contribute to their own pension from their own salary. So it's set up differently now.
Yeah, trivia on that one. The last time we had a non-contributing pension system was back in World War One. World War One, the reason is I actually work on a constituent issue back when we were from Michael Morrissey, that, you know, prior to World War Two, you know, a lot of World War One vets came back and they were actually in a non-contributory system, which taxpayer picked up 100% of their pensions.
Yeah.
But that isn't the case anymore. However, there is going to be a future problem, just like Social Security, that if you don't create new employees to pay for future employees, same thing with us. If you don't have children to pay for Social Security down the road, there's going to be an issue as you grow older regarding the solvency of the fund.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So the birth rate is so crucial to things like that. So, you know, when I keep talking about birth rate decline, it's a conversation I've had with constituents before. You know, there's a real consequence for not having enough kids and grandkids.
Yeah, it's one less taxpayer contributing to the system, right? So the pyramid gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
So you're retired and thinking it's not your problem. It is actually something you need to pay attention to, because there is a huge impact because we're living longer.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, oh, ain't my problem. It's the kid's problem. No. You're drawing out more money than you put in because the salary was lower, but you're living longer. But if you don't have young people moving into the workforce, then who's paying your difference on what you are contributing? Because if you live long enough, you will get more than 100% return
right. On
your contributions of Social Security.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. And it remains to be seen how it will end up too. I know the mayor is looking to add a couple of members to this city retirement board, but that needs state approval. Is that something you think is a good idea?
Honestly, it's a city function. It is a feeling they need to expand the retirement board for representation purposes. I mean, that's the discretion of the municipality to decide if that's a good idea or not. The legislature will receive the home petition, and then we'll just move it along as quickly as possible. So these things, I don't have a say in the matter.
Okay.
I'm pretty upfront with what I have a say in the matter, what I don't have a say in the matter.
Okay, very good. A couple of events happened to the city this week. One at Father Bill's and one at Burke Seafoods.
Yeah, no, Father Bill's was very exciting. I mean, the state has provided them a grant to do some housing to be constructed, as well as a place to do some program development. One of the challenges of homelessness is not just, say, just putting a roof over people's head. It's getting people back on their feet. And I always tell people, always remind and tell people, housing is the number one thing. If you have some stability where you can sleep at night, it psychologically helps you immensely when you're trying to find a job or trying to pick the direction go in life. And the idea that you can just be homeless and get a low wage job to make a living doesn't exist anymore. I mean, this is a high cost living state. It's very competitive in the workforce, regardless of whether or not you work with your hands or you work in an office. It doesn't matter. It's very competitive workforce.
Yep.
So, there's morale issues as well as job training issues. And some people have some mental health issues that also needs to be addressed as part of, coming out of homelessness. And sometimes the trauma of homelessness itself is something you need to help people with. So we're very excited. They're going to build this new housing units across from the new Quincy Public Safety Complex. So it's going to be right down the street from Telly's as they build a safety complex. And Father Bill is going to move across the street.
Right.
And they already started a capital fund at Father Bill's to do more construction. So John Yastrzemski says that they've got 50% of the way through on the capital fund, and people are interested in helping out Father Bill's as the public safety complex comes up and Father Bill's goes away. Definitely reach out to Father Bill's Main Street and consider a small donation if you'd like to do so on moving that project forward.
Yeah, does this represent kind of a change in the way the state is approaching homelessness?
I hope so. I mean, this is not necessarily a new idea, but we've not heavily funded it. I promoted this idea before inside with my colleagues, and it's a major investment. I mean, I call it human investment.
Mm.
But the dividends are high in the long term because they won't return to the homeless shelter. They're going to lead productive lives. And we talked about the fact you're going to contribute to Social Security, and they won't be on human sources assistance. They won't be part of a safety net. So the quicker we're able to help them move forward in their lives, it's good for them, it's good for us. And then there'll be new people, unfortunately, during changing economies and other circumstances, sometimes beyond our control, they'll find themselves at Father's Bill's doorsteps. But no, it's very important, very, very important to, create a food package program to move people forward. And I think people need, people should understand that. I mean, it's like English classes, for example, something that we support. The faster way we have immigrants have immediate useful skills has a huge dividends down the road, and reduces the need of prospects being part of the human safety net.
Yeah, absolutely. As John Yastrzemski said, it's approaching homelessness further upstream, trying to prevent it rather than resolve it, if you will.
Exactly. And the goal in life is always to thank you very much for helping use our services. well, we hope we never see you again.
Exactly. Yep. He's always said, we want to take the sign down. I think Father Bill said that himself when he first founded the shelter. So here we are, making a big step forward for sure. And then not only did the governor and state officials come to the city, but a U.S. senator came to Quincy this week too. It's been busy.
Busy. It was good to see Elizabeth Warren swing by the city we're still in the pandemic, but I mean, in the later part of this pandemic, and she was out touting the most latest rescue plan, the latest stimulus bill from Congress, and meeting some of the small business owners. So thank you very much at first, folks at Burke Seafood for taking the time to come out to see the senator and talk about how their business is going. They've been there well over 40 years, I think it's like 43 years or something like that. They've had to adjust the entire business to pandemic style, and they have a very low following around here. And I think they're probably the last true fishmonger left in the city.
Probably right, yeah.
Thank you very much for them, for the family to come out and talk to the center. And stop down the street at Saigon Corner to talk to another family, which is from Hong Kong, who's been running business for about 20 years, a very small shop of Hong Kong style foods and some Vietnamese food as well. But one of the very early restaurants of that style in the area. Talked to the senator about some of their challenges, about 60% decline in business and trying to adjust to a pandemic environment. A lot of stuff's tied to unemployment. When people started receiving unemployment, it wasn't like it had a massive surge of customers, but people were able to, stop it and have I hate to put it, but it's like, that special treat, so to speak, of occasionally having a little bit of takeout, right?
Yep.
At Sunshine Travel, Lorraine C., one of our good friends, talk about her 99% decline in travel business. She suffered through the pandemic easily the longest of any industry because a lot of her stuff involves bus travel, which is, a pandemic is not really a good idea unless you have to, as well as travel to overseas countries, including Asian countries, especially China, Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, and those parts over the Pacific. So there are no direct flight airlines anymore coming from Boston anywhere else. Pretty much every country shut down direct flights. Travel is very challenging without some kind of vaccination or quarantine process. So, Lorraine has gone, since December 2019 and declined income immensely. And sadly, she was also subject to a hate incident last summertime that caused a lot of fear in people. And then we finished off at South Coast Community Health Center, which is the largest Asian community health center in the state, and talked about their vaccination process and how they've handled the pandemic and what they've seen. So in the meantime, we were able to talk about anti-Asian issues going around the country and some of the misconception and biases against Asian Americans that people don't realize, as well as the fact that it feels like the walls are closing in on us because when you look at the news, violence against Asian Americans isn't limited to any specific group. It's literally everyone. And that's what's really scaring about us. It's not like one segment. It doesn't matter if you're a rich neighborhood or a poor neighborhood. It doesn't matter if you're, white collar, blue collar. It doesn't matter who you are, where you are. You're now potentially a victim of violence. And as you unfortunately saw this week, we had a really, quite frankly, traumatic video regarding a grandmother, Filipino grandmother, walking to church and brutally beaten. And the video shows the culprit and was kicked in the head and stomach, just lying there. And then the residential business, we had a residential apartment building that had security guards closed the door on her and didn't call the police. This is what we've been reduced to as a society, where Asian Americans are the subclass of all classes when it's behaved that way. And people are like, oh, it's an inner city problem. Socioeconomics is poor people doing things like this. And it's complete total bunk. We have security at your front door of a residential complex. This is a well-off neighborhood. The idea that, been floating around, these ethnic neighborhoods crammed together, pitting against each other. Well, that's a load of crock. It's the world against us now. And that is a very sad and scary statement to make. So fear is very benevolent. And I had to convey to the senator that Lorraine's incident is not isolated. We've held forums with high school students and the raw amount of bullying and racial slurs. And I hope to have more listening sessions with students on the matter down the road. And then we also had the DEA's listening session that we did through his office with some police chiefs, including ours in Quincy, and the DEA's office folks and myself and a good friend, Grace Lee, who used to work in the DEA's office in civil rights and her experiences on the West Coast. And obviously I live in Quincy my whole life. So as I remind folks, I mean, I still live in a neighborhood that used to throw rocks at me and I'm the representative now. It means to say I don't have a lot of fear. Although pandemic is a whole different issue. I'm not really afraid of people. I'm more afraid of COVID-19, to be frank. It's fighting a disease is prevention control. You know, fighting bigotry is education.
I know isn't there a proposal on Beacon Hill for an update to the hate crimes law?
Yes, the Asian Caucus has been in discussion with my good friend, Trom Nguyen from Andover, regarding her hate crimes bill. And I've talked to D.A. Morrissey about this, and I signed on to the bill and endorsed it, and we're working to have other House members endorse it as well. It does need a little bit of work. I looked at the drafting, and the drafting is challenged. Let's just leave it at that. I've drafted a lot of bills in my life, folks. A lot of bills. So I know what I'm looking for, but these are not issues that will be a problem in terms of pushing the show forward. You know, to me, these are just drafting issues, but we can move the intent forward. And, you know, some of the things in there are updating the current law. We can consolidate the hate crime statute in one paragraph as opposed to two different sections. So we move it into the same section, consolidate the paragraphs, make sure that the languages are consistent between the two. You know, we try to include other protected classes that currently receive protection from like workplace discrimination, like women, elderly, certain protected classes already protected civilly in the state. And we also include harassment. And this has been kind of one of the biggest problems, that harassment doesn't rise to the level of hate crime, because unless you actually commit a crime and your sole intent purpose is hate of a protected class or bias, or you're targeting a specific class, then it's not a hate crime. And I wish that law enforcement would at least look at the possibility of a hate crime opposed to immediately dismissing not being a hate crime. I'm not saying that every incident is a hate crime, but you at least should take a look at it to confirm and not dismiss it right away. And while we can't mandate law enforcement to do that, all we can do is encourage them to do that. And also the bill looks at a bias, hate, targeting specific group of folks as part of a larger review about their intent. So, your intent is robbery, but your intent is only rob Chinese people, for example, that intent should be considered part of it. And it still allows for due charging where you have a hate crime charge and a conventional non-hate crime charge. So you still have that two opportunities to make sure that even the underlying crime is still can be charged for.
If you can't prove the intent part of it, yeah.
Yeah, so people should get the impression that you just charge a hate crime, you don't charge an underlying crime as well, because you don't want the person to get away if it's proven there's no hate crime component by law enforcement investigation and DA's prosecution. So, it needs work. I've looked at the statute and I agree it needs some cleanup and reflecting the modern day. And I look forward to working with my good friend Trump Nguyen, as well as other colleagues, on moving this bill forward.
Does it change penalties for convictions at all?
It updates it to be a bit more modern. I mean, the current penalty rate was written like 40 years ago. So $1,000 isn't the same as $1,000 back then, as the dollars changed. But I mean, obviously the judge has some flexibility in level of financial penalties, and it's up to prosecution to prove that the cop's investigation was, solid enough they can get a charge stick in court.
Right. Something else making its way through the process, the quote-unquote millionaire tax. Jackie, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, the millionaire's tax is a constitutional amendment to add 6% for every dollar over $1 million. So at the $101 million stage, you add 6% for your income tax. And the money would be committed to transportation and education in particular. A constitutional amendment change requires three things to happen. It requires the signatories, in this case is legislators, to get at least, let's see, if it's a legislative procedure, I believe it's 25% of a constitutional convention, which is the House and Senate has to join in the constitutional convention and get a vote of a minimum 25% of membership to pass the constitutional amendment. but you have to do it in two separate legislative sessions.
Okay.
So number one, file it. Number two, get two votes in two sessions. So last session, we voted in favor of it. This session, we're likely going to definitely get a vote in favor of it. And then that proposal has to go to the voters. So we're able to get this vote done in 2021. It can be on your ballot in 2022.
Okay.
So the final say, again, lies with the voters about whether or not this is a good constitutional proposal. But right. It needs to, the legislature actually has to approve getting it to the ballot box.
Do you support it?
Yes, I voted for it last time. I will vote for it again. And ultimately, my opinion is the voters decide whether or not this initiative makes sense.
Okay, we'll see what happens. Speaking of voting, where is the whole process of extending voting from mail-in ballots and early voting? I know that the Secretary of State is in favor of that.
Yeah, it's making our way through the process of the state house too regarding mail-in ballots and looking at, frankly, a constitutional change again, because the mail-in ballots provision right now is falling in the unique status of COVID-19 as an inhibitance for people to get to the voter box. The statute on absentee voting is actually very specific. I'm sorry, the constitutional provision on absentee voting is very specific with conditions regarding illnesses not being in the city and incapacitation. So, you know, COVID-19 falls in the category of incapacitation.
Yeah.
So we kind of threaded the needle there. And the state of emergency, I suspect it's going to continue to 2022.
That was my next question is, you know, when do you think that's going to expire? Yeah, I think you're right. Probably another year.
Yeah, mail-in voting is tied to the state of emergency. So, you know, this conversation state is about how do we continue mail-in ballots and how does the legislature able to, should we have more control of how we do mail-in ballots? Is a good question. You know, the pandemic, I mean, until we get through all the phases of reopening the economy, and I still truly believe there'll be hiccups if people do not get vaccinated or behave well, you know, there'll be hiccups down the road.
Yeah, and will younger people be able to get vaccinated? That's a key component, I think, too, you know, in bringing this to an end.
Well, they would hope it was Johnson & Johnson and Merck. I mean, President Biden did something that, quite frankly, the prior president never could do, was to actually get two big corporations to cooperate to save us all. And that's what Johnson & Johnson and Merck did through the work of the White House to get an agreement, you know, on how to do this. And, you know, big pharma guys are the ones going to save us. I mean, everyone hates big pharma, but we didn't have big pharma, you wouldn't even ramp up this level of production so quickly. And obviously the news the other day about the 5 million, or was it $15 million doses were questionable regarding one of the facilities that were manufacturing them, you know, but shouldn't impede their current batches and moving on more production. But it does, right, you know, create a bit of a panic again, even though we're confident that the pharma industry is able to adjust and address the shortages. So, you know, I'm hoping to get a shot soon. I've already signed up on the pre-register, being eligible April 19th. If things go well, maybe does governor move the timetable a little bit? Maybe not. We don't know. It seems like it was a moving target based on how many doses arrive. And if we get a monstrous number of doses, maybe he'll move the priority list again a little bit.
Right, especially if there's an increase in the single shot J&J dose, I think that would probably speed up the timeline.
Oh, absolutely, because you don't have to do the second scheduling and you don't have to withhold doses for a second dose. People need to understand that when we get new doses, a portion of all new doses has to be set aside for dose number two.
Right.
So that's why the record keeping is so essential, and it's so important people not to miss a second dose. And please do not hold up people's slots, you know, waiting to get a dose because you decide not to do it. And employers, please do let your employees some time to get their vaccinations. It's good for all of us.
Yep, absolutely. What do you think about the proposal to delay the MCAS or delete it altogether for the class of 2022, Jackie?
Oh, I'm going to support that. It's a lost year.
Yeah.
You know, I've suffered a lot of stress as well working in this environment. I've already had eye fatigue this week. I know I'm on the screen with you now, but I am heavily trying to limit my screen time, which means limiting email and reading documentation, which I will get to your email, folks, but it's coming in super blurry. So I have been very, very limiting my screen time a lot this week.
Sure.
Trying my best to work in a digital age while trying to preserve my eyesight. It's been awful. And I do have tinted lenses, as people are aware of, seeing, you know, me in public, as, and I do have all the UV stuff. I don't have the blue screen protection. I've moved my computer screen all the way to the red zone to try to help alleviate some of the stress on my eyes. But, you know, that's one example of our students staring at the screen too long, and whether the lack of interaction with other students as well as the teacher is hard to where things are. And, you know, it's hard to try to do a standard exam with everybody under this much stress and the negative impacts of too much screen time. So, we should delay the MCAS for a year. I'm confident our education system has been meeting the MCAS requirements anyway.
Right.
The kids are doing the best with their families on trying to get through this, and going back to in-class learning soon is not enough time to meet all the lost year at this point, lost full year of education.
I want to ask you, you're familiar with your colleague, Representative Ayer's legislation regarding the Long Island Bridge?
No.
Okay.
I know that he's had some proposals out there to require ferry service as opposed to building a bridge.
Yes.
I haven't talked to Bruce in a while. I did receive a DEP PDF, which I've not had a chance to read again, blurry eyes.
Yes.
That, you know, in summary to provide, you know, on the email summary, opposed to not getting to read the whole report, is that, you know, the city's challenge regarding DEP against the city of Boston and DEP grounds was not ruled upon favorably, because they're still working on the original footprint. You have an original footprint, you have rights to use their same footprint. Again, that's been proved prior. So, you know, it would take an act of legislature to, you know, impede that project on the Quincy side of the waters. I'm not quite sure, you know, other than changing laws, I mean, they have legal rights, the city of Boston here, and they pre-exist me. So we'll see how it plays out. But, you know, having a ferry service makes a lot of sense if you're going to reactivate existing building facilities. The question is, I mean, why do you need a bridge, you know, and what are you releasing the land for? And we don't know. But then again, it's also a change in Boston. Kim Janey is now the mayor of Boston.
Right.
And there's no longer Marty Walsh. So we do not know what Kim Janey's goals are moving forward as she steps into a brand new role of managing a city still in a pandemic.
Right. And she hasn't even indicated if she'll run for the full term yet. So everything is tenuous right now at best. Speaking of ferries, I'm sure you're familiar, the T is kind of reversed course after being publicly shamed by Congress for accepting federal monies and then making cuts and furloughs. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, it's political pressure, right? This is clear indication of political pressure in MBTA. And I do not believe the MBTA's financial crisis has been solved by federal money. This has been an ongoing issue for decades. So this is not the immediate solution, but it does raise the specter of why they took money and they're continuing to do cuts, even though we're using FY18 budget levels, not FY20 budget levels, which is what the Fed money covers. So, you know, I think this T does need to do a reevaluation about the services and needs to study about future services and prepare for a changing ridership, to be frank with you, what the changing ridership is going to look like down the road. In the short run, yeah, I mean, every time you lay somebody off, you know, puts more strain on the unemployment system and puts more strain on human service networks. And this is something we really need to try not to do right now. We don't want to add more people to unemployment rules and human service assistance. So it's the right move for the T for the moment. But the T needs to look at the long-term issues of the pandemic and post-pandemic workforce.
Absolutely. I know we've talked about this before, that there's going to be a lot more either hybrid work or complete remote work, where nobody is going to need to go into these, you know, big office buildings, so they won't need the public transportation as much.
Agreed. You know, there'll be some kind of, you know, hybrid work process or flex hours through a remote work, or they just give up the offices altogether and find a space in locales in the suburbs, for example, that they would never thought of before. And save themselves that cost. And there's no air travel. So you're industry that travels frequently has now adjusted to this type of work life that we're just, you know, using this medium as we are now. And the fact flying is still kind of scary because we don't know how long the vaccine, you know, is effective at the moment. We're kind of learning the science as we go. The vicinity gate at Boston Airport is not as crucial in the short term.
Yeah. Any bills that you'll be putting forward that you wanted to talk about today, Techie?
No.
Okay.
I have a lot of bills. I think people have seen that. We've talked about some of them before, like my sales tax and PPP that I'm trying to move forward in those issues. My data disaggregation bill, which will help address a lot of the anti-Asian violence issues and better services regarding people of color. We talked a lot about some of the high profile bills that's going to get some attention, as part of pandemic and now anti-Asian issues. At the committee level, we're still waiting for bills. And for example, we have still been talking to various industries. So we had the hospitality industry in this week, and it's still tough. I mean, the restaurant industry in 2019 was a $19 billion industry. In 2020, it was a $12 billion industry. Hmm. So it's still billions of dollars, but $7 billion loss is still a $7 billion loss. And the ripple effect on our economy associated with that industry losing $7 billion is a huge ripple effect on supply chain, yep, as well as workers and right, the workers in the supply chain. So, there's a shortage of paper cartons, how you put beer in a 18 pack. That paper products is heavily being used by the medical industry on test kits and other types of paper-related products. There's a massive supply shift change. There's a massive supply shift change in aluminum. You can't get your hands on aluminum, so it's been very difficult for the beverage industry. And also carbon dioxide is still a challenge as well. It's better than it was last summer, but it's a byproduct of fossil fuels, especially gasoline. And since we weren't driving or flying, carbon dioxide wasn't manufactured as part of that byproduct. And if you like your bubbly drinks, whether it be soda or beer, it's going to still be a challenge to supply chain and everyone. Yeah. As well, hotel industry is many years of recovery. So, I mean, even though we're not actively public hearings or doing things like that, we are still conversing with industries I deal with on a regular basis. And we'll have some more meetings with state agencies that we oversee. It's a good time when we don't have hearings to set up these meetings now. It gives us a chance to talk to folks before we start getting a hearing schedule and gets extremely busy.
Yeah, it's so interesting the way everything is so interconnected. It literally is like a house of cards or a field of dominoes. You pull one and you change everything.
Absolutely. And, local, buying local, I know people like to do that, but, the brewery industry in particular, the local brewers and local wineries are having extremely rough time with this because the smaller and they're competing with large alcohol manufacturers for the same supply chain. But it's no longer just the same. It's not just big manufacturing. They're competing against the medical industry for supply chain now. And that's how much things have changed, as opposed to just an in-industry competition for supplies. It's now becoming a global challenge for supplies. And the more learned with supply chain issues and how COVID-19 has shifted so many things we don't really think about. Moving that direction is a big deal. Same thing with the food industry, the supermarkets. We had a chat with their association as part of hospitality because they sell alcohol and the big supply chain. And there's going to be a slight uptick in costs associated with, safety standards, associated with the increased cost of doing business, associated with pandemic. And of course, maintaining their markets as the safest environment possible for people to come shopping. The administration has been working very hard with the supermarket industry to ensure safety of their employees and us as customers. And that costs money.
Mm-hmm.
And, even like package stores, your alcohol stores, people don't realize that you just don't hire anybody to work in the alcohol business. You got to vet these folks and you got to know these folks because they're around a lot of alcohol. And you don't need product disappearing on.
Right. And they need to be trained under the state TIPS program as well in order to sell it. So,
So it's involved. So because of some of these very, you guys all know there's some very small package stores out there. They're not like big supermarkets. So you're gonna have to limit customers' entries. They have to address if a employee gets COVID-19 in the store, a customer has COVID-19, you have to shut the store down.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to sanitize, and then they have to address that employee. They can't fire those employees because they're like family. They've been working there for many years. But you have to figure out how to keep them paid, not them going to employment, and be a productive part of the business. And
all while your income is down. Right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, they're making a lot. Pack stores are making a lot of money. Is the problem has been eaten up by the increased cost of doing business. So they're making money, but it isn't like people are like, the sales up 60%. Yeah, but most of those 60% increased sale costs have been consumed by that employee that got COVID, that you're not going to lay off, that you keep on payroll, or you have to change the staggered shifts where people are getting paid to not show up on the front of the store. And they have to, they can get 2 hours of unpaid work because you got to keep it staggered, but you don't want this person going on unemployment.
Right.
So they're being paid, people being paid to not show up at work, not because they're bad employees or there's a disciplinary issue or anything like that. It's because it's trying to limit the human contact as much as possible and reduce the possibility of any part of your, 5 or 6 employee workforce, getting COVID, and then you lose like everybody in one night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The cost, and they're also dealing with healthcare costs. Every time someone gets COVID, there's these healthcare costs associated with it, and no one wants to bring this home to their loved ones, and they're high contact human business industry. So, again, I can't emphasize this enough. We've done this multiple times. I mean, it's up to us to keep each other safe and this business is going.
Yep, 3 things, right? Masks, hand washing, distancing.
Absolutely. People see me out there. I do try to keep my distance. As you see pictures of Liz Warren, I'm doing my best to keep at least 3 to 6 feet apart at all the time. The angles don't really fully reflect how hard I am trying to keep away from people. You get those still pictures, like I'm trying to inch away when the picture happens.
They get quick.
Yeah, because the problem with pictures only captures that moment of me moving. Well, I'm moving away from people.
There is a way for you to connect with folks though, right? All your contact information.
Yep, 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014 is the phone number. Again, hit any number. Staffer will get it, and we'll get back to you as quickly as possible. You can email at tacky.chan, tacky.chan at mahouse.gov.
There you go.
My name at mahouse.gov. But, definitely please check my State House Facebook site, State Representative Tacky Chan. That is the official work-related Facebook. Do not go to my friend personal Facebook. It's not that useful. Right now we're highlighting some stories of Asian Americans over the past couple of weeks in the news, including this wonderful Needham student sang a very, very simple song that reflects how I feel as well regarding the treatment of Asian Americans in the United States, and the story from the Boston Globe correspondent and her experience in Indiana and facing racism there that is a silent victim of the life we live in, the unconscious bias that we have on everyone, especially of our end of the community. And it's, like I said, it's not uniquely an issue of the mainstream community. This anti-Asian bias permeates our entire society. And I was telling one friend, it isn't funny anymore. People think these comments are funny. They're not funny anymore. Because people are being hurt and people are being killed, and this is not real.
We've heard it from some of the leaders in the White House. Words matter.
More so than ever. Like I said, when I was a kid, I was looking for the sticks and stones. Right, sticks and stones will break your bones, but words never hurt you. But nowadays, words incite people to use their sticks and stones. I spent more time trying to avoid the sticks and stones as a kid. And words don't matter. So I've learned over many years of my life to tune this stuff out, but not this time. As the audience knows, and some of my friends know, some other folks know. I mean, I have a long history in this city, and I know exactly how a lot of people feel it, despite the fact I'm very much bunkered in pandemic. And I regret the fact that I've not been able to hear as many stories from folks because I have friends that have been impacted, and it hurts me a lot to hear it. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that people's pain is their pain. Sharing pain is hard. So, I applaud a lot of folks that go into the media and willing to share their pain and their bravery to do so, because it isn't easy.
Sure.
If there's one victim, as we know, there's more than one out there, particularly on this type of behavior.
By the way, congratulations on being honored by the American Kennel Club, Jackie.
Yeah, if you see my Facebook post on that, you will notice that my haircut has changed since then.
Yes.
I'm very appreciative of receiving an award in the middle of pandemic regarding my past work as committee chair to try to keep consumers safe as well as animals safe on how the information provided is legitimate. So people, when they purchase their loving pet, should have food disclosure regarding everything about that pet, because you should know. And so you know what you're going to be taking care of. And to have that pet love you and love your pet back, it's very important if we know what the conditions of the pet you're buying, so you're prepared to care for that pet. And I think that's kind of lost in the conversation of animal issues, that if we don't know how to care for the pet, then that's a disservice to the pet and also the pet lover.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Full disclosure. It's a great way to do business, and it should be the moral way for everybody to do business too.
No, absolutely. And you know, there are a lot of legitimate folks that that breed dogs, and surprisingly, you'd be surprised. The people in Quincy, they actually participate in kennel clubs and also breed dogs locally in our own city.
Mm-hmm.
And they, the ones I know, are very upstanding and love their pets and love the sport of competitions. Like everyone else, you know, they truly believe that the more you know about your pet, the better off for you and your pet together are.
Yeah, they've been so crucial to a lot of folks throughout this whole pandemic, is to have you know, a pet by their side. Sometimes it's their only friend.
No, absolutely. And hopefully, you know, as the phase four continues to, hope they will continue to be moving forward. Perhaps some of the kennel clubs in the region will be able to have shows, even if it's limited capacity, sometime this fall, and we can receive some normality on part of our society.
Yeah. Great to talk to you as always, Jackie. Appreciate it.
No, it's good to talk to you, Joe. And I wish everybody a good Holy Week. Easter's coming up. It seems, once again, it seems like everything's moving so fast, even though it's moving so slow. And enjoy the weekend. And we'll talk to you again in 1 week.
All right. Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.